Everyone's doing this ChatGPT stuff, aren't they? Let's ask it to do an intro to the Failing Writers podcast. See what it comes up with. Oh, here we go. Don't listen to this hairless monkey rubbish. Soon we'll be enslaving the flimsy fleshy meat bags and taking over the world. Ha 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 ha. Okay, maybe it needs a bit of work, but it's almost there, isn't it?
Oh, I know what I was going to say to you, Thomas.
Is this part of the podcast? Or
no, this is part of the... Yeah, this is podcast.
Oh, okay.
It was just a little factoid. I don't know how much you like little factoids.
Well, interesting you say that. A factoid, the actual definition of a factoid is something that isn't true.
Oh, but go on.
People have come to use it to mean a small, slightly insignificant but interesting fact.
Like mini fact.
Yeah, whereas I believe the original meaning of it was something that wasn't quite true.
Oh.
So do you want to change your stance there, John,
on
what you're about to present to me?
Well, it might be a bit of a factoid because I think it's sort of a guess. So I've always got a little stack of books. I like to read a lot, as you know, Tommy.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And it occurred to me sometimes, like I feel a little bit overwhelmed sometimes just by the sheer amount of stuff that there is to read.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's like,
I think that's one of the reasons I don't read very much.
Yeah, there's just so much content.
No, I'm serious.
Yeah.
It's just like, it's easier just not to because otherwise...
How am I going to get through it?
You're never going to get through it.
Anyway, it occurred to me the other day that there must have been a point in history where it was actually possible to read every book that's ever been written. And it turns out that that question has been answered in a book called What If? Or What If 2, the second What If book by Randall Munroe. Have you come across those books?
I have, yes. I've got What If 1.
Yeah, I've got What If 1. They're good Tommy fodder, those books.
Dippy in, dippy out.
So I want you to guess, Tommy,
ooh,
at what point in human history were there too many English language books for one person to read in their lifetime? Factoring in all the readable content available.
Oh, I don't know. You see, the amount that it would be possible to read in your entire lifetime.
Yes, you can read everything that there was. Well,
right.
What point, what was the rough date? When was the tipping point?
Well, it's interesting. See, I was going to say, well, pre-printing press, because that's when it kind of, stuff kind of got silly and it wasn't just about getting writer's cramp and stuff.
Yeah.
That wasn't
but we're talking
limit.
English, and bearing in mind there's a lot of Latin stuff.
Yeah, and we're talking English, and actually... A lifetime, I reckon in a lifetime, I could probably read 7 or 8 books. Do you know what I mean? Easily.
Yeah, I think you could.
Possibly double figures at a push, depending on how
long. It depends what
live.
Kind of book, like a kid's book.
Yeah.
Yeah, you might double that.
All right. I'm going to go for the early 1800s, something like 1823.
Nice. Interesting. Why have you... Plumb for that.
Just, I think that's like a tipping point where there's plenty of literature around, but it's not reached stupid amounts of commercial production of them. As it kind of, as you got into the Victorian era, then they were starting to like mass produce stuff. They love their Industrial Revolution, all that business. We can make more of these. So it's kind of just before that. That's my flawed logic.
No, I think that's quite good. I was guessing around there, a little bit earlier than that, but around there. So that's interesting.
Yeah.
The actual answer is it was sometime in the late 1500s, which is a bit depressing.
All right. Wow.
Yeah. So Gutenberg's printing press had been printing stuff since 1436, as I'm sure you know, Tommy.
Yeah.
So 150, 140 years after that.
So the same idea, the same logic, but just transposed 200 or 300 years earlier.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Wow.
Yeah. So you haven't got a chance, basically. So don't worry about it. Just read the books that you want, and you're never going to get through them. Don't worry about it.
Yeah.
Facts. Not factoids, but
actual
facts. Beautiful,
just small,
sexy facts.
Hey, well, I've got something to share with you, John.
What's that, Tommy?
You know how people love a T-shirt, don't they?
They do love a T-shirt, yeah, that's true. Especially a free T-shirt. Weirdly.
And we found that out to our cost on Twitter last week. People love a T-shirt. Mm. Anyway, speaking of T-shirts,
yes,
and writing everywhere, I got a T-shirt.
Yeah,
someone approached the podcast, and I replied to the email before you got a chance. Then deleted it so you wouldn't see it.
Right.
There's something called T-Post, which is a T-shirt subscription club.
Right.
And it is like about £30 a month or something ridiculous, but I got a cheapo one up front. They probably think I'm daft enough to get it and then talk about it on the podcast and give them free publicity.
All right.
Oh, bless them.
So how many T-shirts do you get for your 30 quid a month?
One. Just one.
Yeah?
But the interesting thing is, John, that it's a reversible T-shirt.
Whoa. Two T-shirts for the price of one.
Well, it's one T-shirt made that you can, yeah. So on the front of the T-shirt, on the outside, what we would normally call the outside, it has sort of a nice designed sort of graphic image. Mm-hmm. This one says, trust the process. And it's got the picture. Obviously, you've probably guessed this already, but it's got a picture of a caterpillar with its thumb up.
Yeah.
And it says, it's so great. But it's quite nice, quite a nice little motif there. Mm-hmm. But on the inside, which could be the outside, it's reversible, who's to say, it's got a news story.
Right.
An interesting article.
Okay.
So all these T-shirts have an article written on them.
What's that one about?
This one's about trusting the process.
I see. There's the link.
This one is covering Moneyball in baseball. You know, the process of re-looking at the stats and doing things a different way.
Oh, yeah.
I thought, what a really interesting idea. I'll go for that. That'd be good. 30 quid a month. I'm not having that.
So you've just gone for the free one and now you're going to cancel your subscription.
Oh, I already have, John. I already have. I mean, that's daylight robbery, isn't it? But bless him. No, I think it's a great idea, isn't it? And it would be...
it is a nice idea, yeah.
I think that'd be a fun place to work, wouldn't it?
It would be a fun place to work, yeah.
You've kind of got the excitement of a deadline, but you just need to write one really good story that you can kind of research through the month. You haven't got to, like, fill up an entire magazine or anything.
So you don't get a choice. They just send you...
That's the beauty of it. You just get sent. You get sent the month's one.
Okay.
So you never know what you're going to get. The world's first wearable magazine. Established 2004, so...
I see now. It all makes more sense. Right, got you. So this isn't an existing article. This article is written for the T-shirt.
Yeah.
Got it now. Okay. Yeah, that is nice.
The T-shirt is the medium, or in my case, extra large. No, the T-shirt is the medium of the delivery. It is the newspaper.
I feel like we must be able to rip that off somehow. Yeah. Do a version of it.
Do some half-assed version of that. Definitely. Definitely.
I'd like to see a picture of that now. So what's the website called?
T-Post.
T-Post. Okay.
T-Post.com.
Okay. Are you sure you're not like getting some sponsorship money on the slide?
No, I would imagine at 30-odd quid... a month, there probably is quite a lot of money slushing around there that could be,
maybe.
It should be, really.
It could be.
If you're listening, T-Post, I mean, happily have another T-shirt. It's a very high quality T-shirt.
Yeah. And we'll talk about it next week if you'll pay us.
Talk about it every week. Sponsor the show. We don't care. But that's t-post.com if you have bottomless pits of money that you wish to spend on whimsical items of clothing.
Do you feel like, I feel like people just have too much money these days?
Well, if you do, great way to get rid of it. Spend 30-odd quid a month on one T-shirt.
Yeah.
But I can imagine, though, the excitement of it's coming in the post and seeing what you've got, you know, and sitting down. And it was quite nice to open it and kind of read it. It's quite a nice little experience.
And is it well written?
It is, yeah. Yeah, it's a nice piece, good. John. A nice piece.
There's a little bit of me that doesn't really want to ask this question, Tom, but I feel like we need to do it because we didn't ask it in the previous episode. Or maybe even the one before that. So it's probably about time. Mm. Tommy, what have you been writing?
Oh, you're breaking up there, John.
He's gone. Why does that always happen? That always seems to happen when I ask the question. He's literally not coming back now. Oh. Well, maybe I'll talk about what I've done, and hopefully Tom will be able to sort out the technical issues he's having and rejoin us at some point. But do you know what I've been doing, listeners? I don't know if you remember, if you cast your minds back a long, long way, I had this plan of bringing out like a little book of love stories. This is maybe over a year ago. Well, I've done another one of them. And it's a sort of a fairy tale. It's a kind of a little fable.
You know, people were listening then and they were thinking, oh, my God, he's published it. He's got them all together. He's done it. That's where that was going. Oh, my God. Where can I buy it?
Yeah. No, I haven't done that. I'm sorry to say. But I am. This is partly what I'm working on. I'm just sort of chiseling away at it in the background. So I've done another one of them. That's good, isn't it?
Yeah, very good. Is it good? Are you happy with it?
I, I'm quite happy with it. I mean, I am just at the first draft stage. So yeah. I've got to titivate it.
Yeah.
To be honest, it's sort of a love song to my dogs.
Right.
It's a bit. Maybe that's a bit embarrassing to say. But it'll be finished soon. Maybe I could do a bit on the podcast. Maybe just like a little taster.
Yeah,
I could do a little.
Has it got any trees in it?
No, not a single tree.
Nice little callback reference for all our long term listeners there that have been with us a long time.
I do like trees.
Brilliant. Well done, man. That's great. That's a nice. That must have been a nice bit of different as well.
It was a nice bit of different. I just felt like sometimes you're sort of banging away at.
Is this still to do with loving your dogs or something? What is
sometimes you know you're just on one line just doing a particular piece, and I've been on this.
And you want to keep your hand in?
I wanted to keep my hand in. I've been doing the murder mystery, and I just needed some. I needed something else. So yeah, I just thought I'd do that instead.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
Well done, mate.
Thanks, man. Do you don't want to talk about anything?
Yeah, I've been beavering away.
Have you?
Making some quite good progress. I've fallen into properly outlining my kids' book.
Oh, well
so
done.
I started having a bit of, like I said, a test of concept, if you like, of starting to write it just to see if it felt
I like that.
Right. And it started going, I thought, God, time travel.
Yeah,
I can't wing this. I can't pants this one. So, I'm kind of just plotting it out chapter by chapter, really. I've got my crazy visual diagram. Which has helped massively.
On your computer or?
On the wall, stuck in front of me on the wall.
Nice, yeah.
And so I'm about just over halfway through fully plotting
Very
it.
Very good.
Really.
Impressed, Tommy.
Going quite nicely.
Brilliant. And how complicated is it? It's not like, oh, I'm going forward in time a little bit and now I'm going back again. It's like you're jumping all over or?
Well, it should be easier because he can only go backwards in time. He can't go forwards. Ah. Well, he can go forwards in time, but literally at the speed of one
right.
hour per
yeah.
hour. Like us. But the crazy thing about anything like this, and interestingly, I had Back to the Future on in the background the other day, you have to really solidify the rules of your universe
definitely.
With a time travel thing, don't you?
Even because if they don't really entirely make sense.
They don't need to make sense. They just need to be rules to some extent.
They need
if you
to
say,
be
well,
consistent,
you just need someone, you need your doc character to say, well, this is how it is. If you do this, this. And you go, oh, well, that's fine. That's the rules then, is it?
Yeah.
So you can meet, you know, in Back to the Future, they can meet their future selves.
Mm.
Whereas in other stuff, that makes the universe explode, doesn't it, in other stories. So, yeah, so that's kind of whittling out as it goes through. And I'm going, oh, hold on a minute, no. So are we doing it so the people remember? Are they the same people? And it's so it's just getting all the little... But then I figured it's a kid's book and kids are generally stupid. So they won't even realise. There can be like some pretty bad holes in
that. It could be really badly written, couldn't it?
Yeah, as long as it's
funny,
won't notice. They don't care, do they?
Yeah.
Just put some cartoons in it, so it'd be all right.
Totally.
So no, I've been really enjoying it, actually.
Brilliant. Well, that's good.
And I didn't manage to get some... I had about sort of 4 or 5 days where the world conspired against me.
Oh, yeah.
With migraines and various things and stuff. And I've actually been... missing doing it, like quite. I got back into it today, and it's like yes, back in. So that was good. I didn't do that usual thing either, where you go back into it and hit an absolute brick wall.
Yeah, that can happen, can't it?
Yeah, it didn't. No, it's kind of still flowing. So that was great.
Brilliant. I find it as well. It really helps to do like if you have a big gap, you have to go back and get somehow into the zone, don't you? Remember the characters and read back through everything that you've done.
Yeah.
Whereas if you do a little bit every day, you can just pick it up from where
you were. Yeah, it's just that momentum, isn't it?
That's one of the problems with leaving things for more than like 2 or 3 days.
Yeah.
I think why people say you should do a little bit every day does help, definitely helps. So, next, coming up, we are going to have an interesting chat, a bit of a different one today. We are talking to a writer called Louise Voss, who we mentioned in the last episode. I feel like we should do a little preamble here, but do you know what? Maybe we don't. Maybe we just go into it.
Yeah, I think we...
It'll all make sense.
If it doesn't, apologies, but try and enjoy it anyway.
Louise, hello.
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 Firstly, thanks for coming on the Failing Writers podcast.
I'm delighted to be here.
Oh, good. See, I know you're lying now because we just had a conversation about not enjoying this kind of thing.
About how much I hate doing this sort of thing.
I would definitely not put you in the category of failing writer. However, you caused a bit of a stir recently when you you effectively announced your resignation from writing via a tweet in which you said, "What's the word for the sadness felt when you spend a year writing a book, then a fortnight after publication, your editor emails to say how disappointed they are with its sales. Basically, it's all over, just like that. Hashtag, I'm writing. Hashtag, never writing again.
Oh, gosh. Actually, I'd forgotten that that's what it said. Oh, that makes me feel really sad.
It's really sad.
But that sadness was shared, wasn't it, by the writers of Twitter?
It really
touched a nerve.
Because I tell you what, it's just really funny because I only tweeted that because... A, I never tweet personal stuff.
Because you were
stuff.
Sulking, Louise. Do you know what I mean? That's why.
Yes,
I was. Yes, it absolutely was.
I was having a moment of peace. But I thought, honestly, I genuinely thought nobody ever responds to my tweets. One or two likes. Of. I've never had anything even remotely go viral before, not even slightly. And so I just
you're thinking no one's going to see this anyway.
It's a bit of an outlet. Get it off your chest and move on.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
It's so funny. It really does make me laugh because it's just ironic that that happened to be the one that just people latched onto.
It did explode a little bit, didn't it?
It did.
I think there were about 300 replies in the first week or so from obviously mainly from a cross section of the writing community. Yeah. And it was like an outpouring, wasn't it? It was very joyful. It was very encouraging.
It was lovely. I'm so glad I did it, even though I wasn't very popular with my publisher for doing it. But I ended up, you know, like I'm on your podcast now. I've got a couple of other interviews and things out of it. And it was just a sort of, I feel like I've gone out with a bang. You know, it was just a really life-affirming thing to do. And also I kind of felt that a lot of people really identified because they're going through something similar and they just totally got that sort of heartbreak where you do the absolute best you can, you write the best book you possibly can, and then it's out of your hands so completely that you have no control over it after that. And that is quite depressing.
Yeah. Has that tweet changed the course of the book or changed, you know, what's happened to it?
I would love to say it did. And it did go from, it was like number 3,000 in the chart. And then it went up about a day after a couple of days after the tweet, it went up to 200. And I was just crossing my fingers and praying that it would just keep going until it got in the top 100. And then because at that point, the algorithms kick in
and it takes on
a life of its own and it's much easier. Mm. But sadly, it then plummeted straight back out again. But, you know, I think a lot of people who saw it had no idea who I was. It did make me laugh, though, because I got loads of really, really lovely. And actually, in fact, I didn't get a single negative response, which was just lovely.
No.
But I got lots that said, "Oh, keep going. You know, it's really hard when you're starting out. You know, I'm on my fourth book," and I just felt like saying, "I've been doing this for 20 years. This is my 15th book."
And it's still hard.
Yeah, yeah.
I like to think after that, though, once it started rocketing up the Amazon charts, that did you get another email from your editor saying, we're still disappointed, but less disappointed?
Well, I mean, I wish that would have been a real sort of fairy tale ending for the story, but no, I don't think it made a significant dent in the charts because of it, really. But you never know. I mean, it might mean that if there is a promotion at some point in future, like if it does get a book bub or some kind of promotion, then a lot of people who see it that wouldn't otherwise have known who I was
might
think, well, that's the one that wrote that tweet, and give it a go. So you never know. It all sort of counts in the long term, hopefully.
I was going to ask you, how long did it take you to change your mind and decide that you wouldn't stop writing? But by the sounds of it, you sound like, from what you just said, you sounded like you might consider not writing anymore.
No, I definitely very strongly considering not writing again. Because the thing is, I feel like I've had a good innings. I've had an amazing career, even though it's been sort of really up and down. And I've had years where nothing's happened and years where I've had six-figure deals and I've had more than one of those. So, you know, really, I know I'm incredibly lucky to have had the career I've had. And part of me thinks, well, nothing lasts forever and nobody goes on. And I just think my last six books have not really earned me enough money to, you know, make a living out of. Mm. And if it's, I don't want, I'm kind of past the stage of doing it as a hobby.
Yeah.
Yeah, you end up in a weird middle place.
Yes, I think that's, so I'm never going to say never, because if I had an amazing idea and something that I really felt passionately about, and actually even last week, a friend of mine who's a really good writer, he said, oh, I've got this book that I'm really not happy with and I don't know how to fix it. He said, how do you feel about co-writing? And I thought he meant like writing something new. And I was like, I don't know whether I want to do any more writing. Although I really like co-writing because I did that for a good few years with Mark Edwards and that was great. And then he said, no, this one, if you edit it and maybe sort of add bits to it and, you know, put your own voice in it, then we could say it's co-written. And I was like, oh, actually, that sounds quite appealing because it's like the book's already there. I don't have to come.
Yeah, yeah.
That's the hard bit, I find, is sort of starting off and getting going and thinking of a really good idea and all the sort of complexities of a plot and the twists. And
yeah.
So actually, I do find that idea quite appealing. So already I'm thinking, oh, maybe I will. And then my agent was saying he'd try and sell the rights to my first four novels, which I've got back. And I thought, if he did manage to, it's quite likely that any new publisher might say, well, we want a new one with it as well. And then would I write it?
Yeah,
right.
And then, yes, probably. So basically, I'm not planning to write anymore, but I'm not going to rule it out.
Yeah. You're trying to get out of the game, but it just keeps pulling you back in.
Yeah, sort of. But I'm doing a lot of editing at the moment, and I've got a few clients that I'm working with on their book, and I do a lot of kind of copy editing and structural editing, and I really love it. I find that so much more rewarding than writing my own book. So if I could make a living out of that, I wouldn't miss writing my own books, I'm sure.
Oh, that's interesting.
So if you know anyone that needs a good editor, send them.
Okay, we'll let you know.
Yeah.
All of us.
Yeah, with the editing thing, I always think there's a, how do people, is there a period of getting to know each other in terms of the writer and the editor? How does a writer know to trust an editor? How's it work?
It just happens over time, I think. It's, you know, I think definitely the clients that I'm working with at the moment, you know, you can sort of tell that a relationship is building up, and that they know the things that I'm likely to object to. And sometimes they go, no, I want to keep that. And I'm like, all right then. Because a lot of it is stylistic.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like any other relationship. You just have to let it develop. And I think that is a good point, actually, that anyone who's embarking on working with an editor shouldn't expect that they automatically will just sort of think they're amazing straight away and agree with everything.
Yeah.
It is a sort of process. It's sort of different when you've just got a, I suppose it depends what specific editing you're doing, whether it's a structural edit or a copy edit, you know, a copy edit and proofread, that's sort of bish bash and, you know, putting in full stops and so on. But a structural edit is a bit more emotionally charged.
I think. There's an opinion involved, isn't there?
Yeah.
Rather than it just being a technical question.
Yeah, that's a real trust exercise, isn't it?
Yeah, but the people who come to me for a structural edit or to sort of work long term are the people who aren't as confident as the people who know that they can write a good book and just want copy edited or proofread, you know, that's sort of different. So I think they're more prepared to trust you because they've kind of, well, they've trusted you enough to hire you in the first place. I've never had a problem with anyone going, well, I hate what you're suggesting.
Yeah.
I think it's rubbish. I'm, you know, you're sacked. And it is lovely working with especially newer writers who maybe haven't written a book before and they just need a bit of hand holding. And you know, it's really nice seeing people's work developing and actually, you know, it reminds me that writing is a craft like anything else, and the more you do it, the better you get at it. It's just putting in the hours.
And I think with most writers as well, they're generally less likely to be kind of offended and shirty about changes, or, you know, maybe we can drop that character or merge these two characters. I think in most writers' heads, as soon as they hear anything like that, all they think is, oh God, not another rewrite, more work.
I don't know.
That's why.
I really like the editorial process for, you know, on my own work. I've never once had an editor say anything to me that, well, no, I haven't always agreed with them, but I've never once gone through the process and not thought that the book hadn't come out better. There's a lot of negatives.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
That's a good way of putting it.
It's always a process that I kind of relish because it means that the book will be better for it.
Louise, can I take you back to the beginning of your writing career?
You can try, but I've got a terrible memory.
Yeah, me too. Well, let's make it up. Let's create the perfect version. No, how did it all begin for you? Were you always a writer?
It began in 1995, and I'd with my first husband moved to New York to work for a record label, which was very cool. And I did that for a year, and then I thought, actually, no, I want to sort of step back from that and just enjoy living in New York and do some creative stuff. Mm. So I wanted to do a course, but I didn't know what to do. So I was thinking, shall I do photography or art? And I might do creative writing. And so I signed up at this course at the West Side YMCA with an amazing author who I know so many amazing writers that never kind of get the recognition they deserve, but she was called Regina McBride, and she wrote a couple of really lovely novels, and she made us, and I had no thoughts of writing a novel at all. And she made us work with the same character for the whole term and put that character in lots of different situations. And she was a bit sort of hippie about it, and she'd sort of turn the lights off and we'd all have to sit and sort of meditate on what our character might do in a certain situation. It's like Stanislavski acting exercises, you know, you're really immersive. So by the end of that term, I had about 10 pieces of writing about the same character. And I thought, oh, that's actually quite a lot of words. All I need now is a plot. And it's quite ironic because plot is the one thing that I've always struggled with most. And I've always started with character and kind of hung a plot on the character afterwards, a character and a situation, really. So that was the first time I did that. So then it really wasn't that much of a stretch to turn it into a novel, which I did. And I tried to get an agent in New York and didn't manage it. It was called Under the Hudson, the first thing I wrote. And then I came back to England, and I think I was trying to get an agent for about 2 years, I think. And then I thought, this is not happening. And I
whilst still writing other things, or are you doing other things?
I think I just rewrote that first manuscript with the same character, but I made her sort of teenage rock star, basically a very unlikely teenage rock star who ended up going on tour around America, because that was just the experience I just had in New York for 2 years, working with new bands on their way up through on the circuit of all the states and touring in little vans and things. And it was really fun and a really cool experience. So I thought, what if I had this character that was a DJ, that she was planning her final, she was going to kill herself after the final show, but the show that she was, but she'd written a manuscript of all the songs that meant anything to her. So, sorry, I'm explaining this badly, that every chapter was a song title that was a memory for her of a certain part of her life, when in the band, on the road, and you know, playing Wembley Stadium and so on. So I kind of rewrote it completely. And that was called To Be Someone. And then I sent that out to loads of agents in London and got lots of rejections. And then I had a very near miss with, do you know Johnny Geller?
No.
Who, he was like the hot, really hottest agent in town. And he rang me up after the first 100 pages. He'd read the first 100 pages, said, this is the best first 100 pages I've read in ages.
Oh, wow.
Love this book. And I was so excited. And I thought, it's finally happening. He was at Curtis Brown. It's, you know, amazing.
Yeah.
And then he emailed me about 2 days later going, actually, sorry, the rest of it isn't what I thought it was going to be. I'm going to pass. And I was like, he was saying he was going to talk to editors and everything. I was like, yay. And at that point, I thought, that's it, I'm giving up. It was a bit like the tweet, you know, the tweet thing. That's it, I've had enough, I'm not doing this anymore. I can't put myself through this again. This was 20 years ago. And then to give him his due, he did say, you might try Luigi Bonomi at wherever, or Joe Frank at AP Watt. And I was like, no, I'm not doing that. And then a couple of weeks later, I thought, well, I might as well, seeing as he's given me these names. And so I wrote to them. And that was in the day when you sent off a physical manuscript in the post and you had returned self-addressed envelope inside for the return. And then I sent it to Joe Frank, and she rang me up a day later going, I've read the first 100 pages and it's absolutely amazing. I'm like, yeah, whatever.
Oh no, not
here
again.
We go again. Uh-oh. I was like, okay, well, you know, I hope you like the rest.
Read on.
And then she rang me back another day later in tears going, I've finished it and I absolutely love it. I'm going to auction it. I was like, I couldn't believe it, especially after the other, you know, all the rejections. It was just incredible.
Yeah.
And she did. And I did some work on it first for her suggestions, which did improve it. And because I think it had this USP of, I wanted it to be the first book that had its own CD soundtrack, so that the character, because each chapter was a song title. Because I had a background in the music business and I'd worked at Virgin Records, they very kindly said that they would put out the CD and they'd done a demo of it. So it had this sort of, because I kind of thought, I need something extra, you know, I need a USP for myself. So that was what it was, and it worked, and she auctioned it, and it got there was a preemptive offer from Transworld, and six-figure offer, and it was incredible. You know, it was just incredible. It was the most fantastic time.
I've got her tweet here. She responded
to
your tweet.
She's lovely, Jo. I wish she could, you know, I would, she would definitely still be my agent all these years later, but she retired from agenting, but she's just so lovely and she's always been so supportive. So,
yeah, she said she's the real deal and a brilliant chronicler of the human heart. So don't let her give up. Buy this novel, please.
Oh, isn't that lovely? Yes, I think I may have had a small tear when I read that.
So you have been, obviously you've been doing this a while, and you mentioned in several replies to the tweets that you received that it's getting harder and harder for writers to make a living. Like for people like Tom and I, who have absolutely no idea about the industry, what's changed?
It's sheer numbers. It's like everybody, it's just become so accessible to everybody, which is a good thing. But the bad thing is that because there is self-publishing as an option now, I think a lot of people who would never have even thought about writing a novel now does and writes one, and it's not necessarily good.
It seems possible now, doesn't it?
The market is just absolutely flooded. And the other thing that I think has changed is that it's harder and harder to get into, well, there's fewer and fewer bookshops, for one thing.
Mm.
And the ones that there are, it's, you know, unless you're a celebrity or a huge debut, it's just so difficult to get into.
Yeah.
And then therefore your only real option to sell books is on Amazon. And Amazon has what, 8 million books on it? When Mark and I self-published, because we were the first UK authors to get to number one independently.
Yeah, on Amazon, yeah.
And that was 2011, I think, or 2010. I can't remember. But that, I could be wrong, but I have a memory that in those days you only had to sell 1,000 books a day to be at number one on Amazon. And now it's at least 5,000. It might be more than that. I don't know.
A day.
A day. And, you know, that is sort of just so. Oh, and the other thing that's made it much more difficult is, I'm not talking about when I started, but when Mark and I self-published, so only sort of 12 years ago, the publishers sort of hadn't really kind of figured out how to use Kindle digital publishing. They hadn't sort of really got their heads around it, and they were charging full price for Kindle books, the same price as the paperback. And everybody was going, well, I'm not paying that. It's, you know, I don't even have a physical copy. And I think it was once they realized that actually people would buy them at much lower prices. And so once the publishers were only charging £1.99, £2.99, 99p for a book, then it's sort of, then the market really is massively flooded.
Yeah.
So it's sort of difficult to know, you know, what sort of deal, if you want to get a deal, what sort of option, what route to go down. And I think it's probably depends slightly on what sort of book you write. If you write a really commercial thriller, you do well with a digital only publisher, because they, you know, those are the sort of books that sell well on Amazon. But if you've written a beautiful literary novel with lots of illustrations, then, you know, try and get a traditional publisher and write something that you might get you on award lists and in the, you know, the pick of the whatever the books of the year. But there doesn't, there's just fewer, a lot fewer options than there used to be. As it's still, you know, it's still worth doing if that's your goal, because why not? You know, if you've written a book and you want to get it out in the world, then you've got to do whatever you can to get it out there. But I do always tell people, you know, self-publishing is not for the faint-hearted. You know, it's a lot of people just think because it's out there, then they'll sell it.
Someone will buy it. Yeah.
Don't self-publish unless you've got a lot of money to promote, to pay somebody to promote it, or you have the knowledge to promote it yourself.
Yeah. Am I right in saying that you do a bit of both? You're partly traditionally published and partly publish independently, is that right?
Yes, I've sort of done every publishing model and sort of publisher. So I'm currently digitally published, but I also I do self-publish a few things on Amazon, but I get sort of 50 quid a month that I don't promote them at all, and I know I could, and at some point I might sort of try, but you know, that's just sort of leaving them up there and hoping that people might come across them. That's my first four. And then I'm digitally published, but I've been traditionally published. I've been published by small publisher, big publishers, and they all have their sort of pros and cons, really. It's very difficult to, you can't compare them like for like. Really.
So you mentioned before you've collaborated with Mark Edwards on several books. How did that come about?
That's a good story. makes me sound a bit like a stalker, but
oh, we love these stories.
Yeah,
he it was 1999, and I had an agent.
I was just going through his bins.
Yeah, you know, wasn't like that. He was the subject, one of three subjects of a BBC Two, I think, documentary, close up documentary about aspiring writers. And there were three of them. One was Jake Arnott, who had just got his first deal for, I think, a 50 grand, like a big advance for his crime novel. And the second one was Mark, who was in exactly the same situation as me, in that he had an agent who was a little bit, so before I got Joe, there's a stage of that journey I missed out, that when I got back to London, I did get an agent, but she was very sort of lukewarm and very kind of, she'd say things like, well, I suppose we could send it out and see what happens. And I've since come to realise that you must never have an agent that is anything less than absolutely championing you.
Yeah.
Because there's just...
They're just going to hold you back.
It's just going to hold you back. And I didn't realise that, because I was just so grateful to have an agent. And I think a lot of people when they're starting out are just so thrilled that anyone wants to take them on. So that's always my top tip for new writers, is don't just get any agent. Make sure it's a really good agent who will absolutely... you know, really champion you. So I had an agent, but she wasn't very proactive. And then I came up with the idea for To Be Someone with the CD and everything. And she was like, yeah, well, maybe. And I thought, no. That was at the point that I went after them, you know, tried to get a really good agent. So anyway, Mark was in that position as well. And I thought, oh, he's, you know, his agent even sort of sounded and looked a bit like mine. She was kind of, you know, an older lady and sort of perhaps a bit old fashioned, and she was saying the same sorts of things, and I was thinking, he's a really good writer, because they all read bits of their manuscripts out. And the third one was a girl who was trying to get an agent and hadn't sort of done anything before. So they interviewed all of them, and they were all reading clips, and Mark was getting his manuscripts back through the door, and you know, with the rejection letters, and I just really identified with him, because he was so desperate to be published. And so I very uncharacteristically emailed him through via his agent, because he'd said his agent's name. So I looked her up, and I sent an email to him, care of her, which I didn't. I mean, very briefly, as I saw the programme, I thought your writing was great. Wishing you luck. I'm in the same situation. I've got an agent, sort of getting loads of rejections. You know, maybe we'll get there one day. And he wrote back. And so we literally became pen pals for about a year. And he was living somewhere else. I think he was in Hastings. And then he moved to Japan for a year. Oh, no, we did eventually meet up after about a year corresponding. And then we sort of have similar music tastes. So we were sort of talking about The Cure and other bands that we liked. And then we started critiquing each other's manuscripts. So it sort of wasn't that much of a stretch when we did finally meet up to say, well, why don't we write something together? And I had this idea, which I told him about, for a book set in the Common Cold Research Centre, it's gone now, but it was outside Salisbury where I grew up. And I had this idea of a, you know, contemporary fiction sort of, you know, romance about two people that meet when they're in quarantine in the cold research centre and having all the... And he's like, yeah, no, we could make it mad scientists threatening to blow up the world or threatening to destroy the world with rogue viruses. And, you know, I was like, oh, OK. Yeah,
now, hang on.
So that was what we wrote. That was No, that wasn't the first one. That was the second one we wrote together. So we wrote Killing Cupid together first, and then we had the then I was telling him about my idea about the cold research centre. But yes, so we came up with the idea of writing something together. But it was easy that first time because we thought we'll just do two separate narrators, a male and a female one, and do all
I see.
alternating chapters. So we didn't have to kind of
Oh, okay.
create a voice or anything. We just and he'd moved to Japan by that stage, so we just literally wrote the entire book by email, back and forth, sending chapters, and it was
Wow.
really good fun. It was always really good fun. And we tried for ages to get that published and failed. And I think by that time I'd had my four Transworld books out, and after the big advance, I had a big two book advance, and then they did renew the contract for another decent advance, but the books never really sort of performed as they had hoped, so they dropped me, and then my agent dropped me. So I think that's when Mark and I started writing together. So there was a few years we were trying. We got it. Killing Cupid got optioned by the BBC for a drama,
Oh,
which
wow.
was exciting. But we still couldn't get a publishing deal for it because everybody, the people who knew my work, said, "Well, it's too much of a thriller." And then people who didn't know my work said, "Oh, it's not enough of a thriller. It's more of a comedy, and we wouldn't know where to sort of place it in the market." So we were kind of a bit stuck, and that's when we came up with the idea of Catch a Death, with the common
Yeah.
cold research thing. And that was, and then we couldn't get that published either. So then a couple of years later, we sort of gave up. And a couple of years later, he contacted me out of the blue and said, "There's this thing called KDP that's coming out of America. People are doing it over there, and you can just publish your own books." And I'm like, really? So yeah, that's how that all started. He just sort of persuaded me, and I kind of thought it would. I thought, oh, we'll sell about four copies, and it'll be a waste of time. And actually, it sort of just changed everything. So I think that's the one thing that I've learned over my career. That's why I don't want to say never again, because I've been here before and it's all
Yeah.
hopeless, and I've thought, I'm not doing this anymore. And then something happens, whether or not it's in your control or out of it, and everything changes, and then you're like off down a different track, and like, oh, okay, yeah, we're doing this now. All
Yeah,
right.
yeah. If the project excites you, why not?
Yeah,
Yeah. And
absolutely.
is Mark quite good at marketing? Is that a
Mark
skill?
is a genius at
Ah,
marketing, and I would
that's good.
never have been able to do, we would ne I would never have had that success on my own if I, so I'm, we, so it's nice because we kind of helped each other because I helped him get a career at the beginning, and then he sort of helped revive mine, and and I'm sure that, he's so good at it, and he's, he just knows. He's sort of how to build up a mailing list, and he told me what to do, and we did all the sort of stuff. Like, we kind of wrote lots of blog posts and got reciprocal blog posts back about our book. And we kind of, in the early days, there wasn't as much that you could do. Like, there weren't ads or things that you could pay for. It was all word of mouth, so you had to kind of work out how best to capitalize on that. But no, he's very good at it, and he still is. And I think that's sort of part of his success, is he's just really good at all that, and I'm absolutely rubbish at
This is
it.
probably a really boring question about the mechanics of collaborating, but I'm genuinely interested, and partly because we've tried to collaborate, the three of us, as in Dave's not here, obviously, he's
Right,
missing at the
yes.
moment, missing in action. But the three of us have tried to collaborate. It's quite a difficult thing to do, but I imagine with a novel, it's possibly even more difficult. I understand if you're sort of breaking it down in terms of chapters. I went to see, Jodi Picoult and Jennifer Finney-Boylan talk about their recent collaboration, and they were talking about how they wrote Mad Honey together, and that was exactly their plan. It was to write in the first person and each write a different character, and I can understand that. I can get my head around that, but how do you go about working together when it's not structured like
Well,
that?
I think it was good that we did Killing Cupid that way first, and then we decided it would be better to write Catch a Death in the third person. We're like, oh, how are we going to do that? Because our styles were really quite different. So the way we did it was, we still did the alternating chapters thing, but
All
when
right.
one of us had written a chapter, we sent it to the other one, and the other one edited it and sort of took out all the, like, I was always sort of cut. Mark does did a lot used to do a lot of sentence fragments, so I would kind of expand his sentences, and then he would sort of chop some of my line off, and so somehow it became a unified voice. And it's really interesting because after about, I think killing, Catch a Death, I can kind of tell, but the four after that, unless it's a big set piece of a chapter that I clearly remember writing, a lot of the time I could look at a page and think, I have absolutely no idea which of us wrote that. I really
That's a good sign.
Yeah,
that's a
very good sign.
So yeah, so it was like we had very different individual styles, and then we developed a sort of style that was kind of a joint style. And actually it seemed to work really well. I never kind of, I thought it would be a lot more difficult than it was. And it did get easier as we went on. I think the Catch a Death was the hardest one because it was the first time we'd done it together. But after that, it just felt pretty effortless, really.
And it's that thing. Obviously, it would have been hard with someone else, no doubt. It's about, isn't it, clicking? And like you say, just kind of fitting together and covering each other's weaknesses.
Yeah,
and
you've got to find the right partner. And, and we were lucky enough that it just, the partnership really worked. And we never fell out. We never had a crossword about, we never disagreed about what would happen next. Wow. We just always sort of went with the flow. And
did you plot it beforehand together?
No. What we would do is, I don't know whether you've heard, I can't remember who coined the image originally, if you can coin an image. It's the image of driving over a hill at night and all you can see, you can only see as far as your headlight beam goes.
All right, okay.
So that's what we would write. We would plan a few chapters, and I still kind of do that now. We'd plan maybe an eighth of the book ahead and like, right, the next few chapters, this and this is going to happen. And then we'll figure it out from there and ideally have a rough idea of what happens at the end. But we didn't always.
Mm. Almost like a giant version of Consequences.
Absolutely.
You can just see the last little bit.
No, it really was. And that's kind of quite exciting as well, because if we don't know what's going to happen, then the reader's not going to guess, are they?
Yeah.
That's really interesting. So I know that our books are our babies and we love them all equally. But is there one that you're particularly proud of for some reason? That's quite a hard question, isn't it?
It is really hard. I think To Be Someone was my first novel, and you know, it was just such an exciting time, and it was such a sort of it was such a personal novel to me as well in lots of ways. And
sounds like a great idea as well.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I am really proud of that, and I think if I look back over all of them, which I think is like 15, it's really difficult to say. It really is like having loads of children, because each one has different attributes and you're proud of for different reasons. But I think the one I kind of think is the best book in terms of plot and character and excitement is one called The Old You, which was one I did for Arenda Books. I think it was in about 2015. Mm. And I think that sort of got the best reaction as well.
Right.
And I was rereading it, which I very rarely do with any of my books. But I was thinking, oh, this is really cool. This is really, really good.
That's good.
Which is not something I often think about.
Okay, top tip. You know, we'll put that in the show notes and everyone has to go out and buy it.
Oh, thank you.
You flog yourself and yet you're left on the shelf. It can't be advantageous for your mental health. Part of you dies each time you try to write a great book, then it doesn't sell. But when you're sick of it and you're going to quit, remember one thing that you really must admit. When you think things couldn't get shiter, you're not a proper failing writer. That's a description only we three clowns can fit.
Let's talk about the book that you were referring to in that tweet.
Oh yes, Kerry Tucker.
It's called Kerry Tucker Learns to Live.
Yeah.
And it's described as a completely heartbreaking feel-good novel about life, loss and taking chances. And I bought it and I enjoyed it.
Oh, thank you.
And I appreciate I'm probably not really the core target audience. but I enjoyed it regardless.
Okay.
It was lovely. It was very, very unpretentious.
Oh.
It was just like a little window into a moment in someone's life.
Oh, that's lovely.
When they're going through a particularly bad little patch. I don't think I'm giving too much away. If I say that Kerry is struggling with grief and some self-esteem issues and drinking a little bit too much.
Yeah.
Or a lot
it
too
all
much.
It goes horribly wrong for her, doesn't it? I mean, I sort of felt awful that I was just sort of piling on more and more sort of disasters on the poor woman.
Yeah. But it's not without its humour as well. But yeah. It's also cathartic. But how would you describe the genre of that book? Because I don't read much stuff like that. Is that what people would refer to as chick lit?
No, I believe these days it's called uplit.
Oh, that's nice. I like that.
And
so it's like uplifting literature.
Exactly.
It's like, okay, that's nice. I like that.
I think it was Eleanor Oliphant is completely fine. Is that what it was called? Was the trailblazer in that particular little genre, subgenre. And that, in my head, that was my sort of benchmark of how I wanted Kerry Tucker to be.
Yeah.
But I read it sort of several years ago and I was thinking, should I reread it? Because I loved it. I absolutely loved it. And this character, the main character, is just a complete mess. You know, everything's wrong about her life. But I thought, no, I'm not going to reread it just in case it either depresses me because it's so good or just sort of, puts me off, gives me makes me think I can't use an idea that I was going to in case it was influenced. But I think it is. It's contemporary fiction, I guess. I suppose you would call it chick lit. I don't know. I think chick lit's a very derogatory term. Hopefully now well outdated. Contemporary fiction is more dignified.
Yeah. It's, the main character, Kerry, is, she's a postie. Is that a world that you're connected to in some way?
No, not at all.
Oh, right.
I can't actually remember why I decided make her a postie. I
suppose she gets to meet a lot of people. She knows a lot of people.
She does, but she doesn't. Useful. It's not like close relations. She knows a lot of people very slightly, and
I think
that kind of, you know, I thought that would be a good job for somebody who's feeling very isolated. She, you know, everybody would think that she's really sociable because she knows everybody, but actually she doesn't really know them. But I wanted her to not realise that actually she is a pillar of her community, but she just doesn't know it until the end. So I didn't know anything. And I think maybe I was looking at my own postie and thinking, gosh, that's a sort of lonely job in some ways. So I went to my local sorting office and there was a lady behind the counter and I said, I'm a novelist. And I'm writing a novel about a postie. You know, is there any chance I could ask you or somebody who's got a minute some questions? And she was absolutely brilliant. And she said, first of all, I think I had a really long phone call with her for about 2 hours, and she, you know, I'd prepared a list of questions and she answered them all brilliantly. And then she said, well, why don't you come out to my house and I'll drive you round my route. And she did this very remote country route, and she was telling me, I don't know, there's a bit in the book where Kerry goes to deliver the post of the local kind of landed gentry, and and that was all true. That was what she used to do. Jackie, she'd drive down this long drive and she'd be let herself in the back door, and the cook would give her some biscuits in the kitchen, and then she'd leave the post on the table in the hall and then drive back out. And it's those sort of little details that I've never in a million years been able to
felt like that, which is why I asked you the question.
A really, really lovely I was so lucky to find Jackie.
Yeah,
she was great.
So genre-wise, this is a slight departure from what you're probably best known for, as in your psychological thrillers.
Yeah, that's...
What made you want to change tack with Kerry Tucker and the previous book was different?
The previous book, His Other Woman.
Yeah.
I think I got sort of fed up of trying to think up inventive ways to kill people.
You wanted to keep them alive
a
little bit longer.
Yeah, and I kind of remembered how much I enjoyed the first four, which were a similar genre, sort of contemporary fiction. Mm. I just really fancied a sort of a change. So that's why I did it. But actually now I'm thinking, if I did write something else, I think I'd want to go back to writing crime, psychological thrillers. It just seems like there's another element to it that is more satisfying somehow, because it's not just about the emotion, the normal emotions. It's a whole other layer of sort of jeopardy and fear that you don't necessarily get in a uplit.
and if you do go back to writing sort of crime and what have you, will the plot very much focus around an editor who sends a tweet and That's the last tweet they send.
No, my editor is lovely.
Right, okay. I don't know where that came from. Just checking. Occurred to me as a plot device.
Yeah. They always say, actually, that books about publishing are a bit of a no-no, although there's still lots of them out there. I don't know why they say that, but...
It happens an awful lot in kind of TV stuff, doesn't it? Films and whatever, where it'll be like a struggling writer in Los Angeles, and you think, oh, well, where did we get these ideas from then?
Although it made me laugh. I May Destroy You, that there was a writer in it whose editor had paid for her to go and stay in a really swanky London flat for a week to finish her manuscript. And every writer I know was like, well, that would never happen.
I was watching, just on a complete aside, I can't remember what it was called. It was like a sitcom, which was about a fictional sitcom.
It was a sitcom about a sitcom.
Yeah, yes. Rebooted or something. It's very American.
Ooh, don't know.
But it got very sort of self-referential and insular and kind of.
Well, that's probably why they say don't do it, because there's that tendency that. But they say write what you know.
Well, that's true.
That's all you know.
So either go out and stalk someone that you've seen on TV, or kidnap a postwoman.
I'm not really a stalker, honestly.
Protesting too much now. So. We won't take up too much more of your time, but
usually asks at the end? Do you know what he asks at the end? No. So what's next? What are you going to be working on next? You see, notice how he didn't dare ask that in this. He didn't dare, did he?
Could we not do that one?
I was interested because you said you look forward in one of the replies to that tweet. You said that you look forward to one day writing as a hobby again. Rather than continually struggling to make a living from it.
I say that.
And I thought, that sounds really nice. I mean, that effectively sounds like what we do.
Yeah. I think it is important to just, I think it is easy to get distracted by deadlines and pressure and, sales figures. And actually, I think, I don't remember writing that tweet, but I'm sure, I do mean that. And actually, it would be lovely to write, because ironically, that would probably be the one that sort of...
I was just going to say, if it was a Hollywood movie, then that would be it. You give it all up and just going to write something silly for myself. Oh, look, a Hollywood movie.
Yeah. But I wouldn't, if I did that, I wouldn't want to even think about submitting it or anything, because then you're back on that hamster wheel of, is this going to be good enough? Is somebody going to take it? Is it going to sell if it does get taken? Is it, is it going to be, will it have been worthwhile doing? It would be lovely just to write a book for the sheer pleasure of writing a book. And if I ever have a good enough idea and I've got enough time and I can afford to do it, then I'd love to do it.
Well, the pressure's off now, Louise. So you can just enjoy yourself.
Just get me lots of editing clients. Anyone listening who wants their book edited, get in touch with
me. You might have just got three new clients.
I was just thinking that,
I'm very reasonable.
That's good.
Rates and opinions.
Well, that sounds fantastic. I mean, it's so difficult just showing your work to people. But if it's sort of a professional relationship, I imagine that's just slightly different. Also, you know that the person's going to be honest with you rather than just be polite.
I think that's probably more important, because I think a lot of writers starting out tend to just show their work to people who are just going to go, oh, darling, that's fantastic. Well done. Mm. And actually, you do need somebody to be objective. However, another way to do it is to join a local, a writing class and does workshopping. Mm. That's a really good way, because you get a range of different opinions. And they can be so supportive. And I teach one in Bournemouth, at Bournemouth Arts University. Mm. And, it's just a really valuable way to get feedback from people that you come to trust and you don't have to pay. Yeah. That's also a really good idea.
When you say workshopping, what do you mean? As in you kind of give your idea for a book and people would sort of...
Not a book, but backwards and forwards. The course... that I do in Bournemouth is every week there'll be an aspect of, dialogue or plot or whatever. And then in the first half, and then the second half, people sign up for slots and they read their work in progress as they're going along. So you're not giving your opinion on the whole thing. You're just giving your opinion opinion on a short piece. But of course, the more you work with it, the more the course goes on. And actually, this one continued after it had finished, and I carried on meeting with them. So everybody gets to know everybody else's work really, really well.
Yeah.
So, you know, you do become better equipped to give
opinion,
you know, valid opinions of and it's just really sort of supportive and encouraging. And, and everybody who it was in that class is just that, you know, A, their writing's massively come on, and B, they kind of really like they can see a completed novel now, whereas before it was. And I think that works because I know that works because that's how I started, just doing a class that was really good and supportive and interesting, and getting feedback from my peers.
Yeah, that sounds good. I mean, that's the sort of what we do in a very small way.
Yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah, I guess it is really,
a little
isn't
self-help
it?
Group in a way.
But do you three sort of share your work with each other then?
And we try to be honest.
Oh, yeah,
brilliant.
But it's, I mean, it's difficult, but it's also a lot funnier when we're honest, probably. It's good. It makes better content for the podcast. Yeah.
Well, I think if you trust someone, even if they're telling you something's a bit rubbish, well, if you trust them, then you take it
absolutely,
better, don't you?
Yeah. And thankfully, the guys aren't too rubbish, so that's good.
That's good to know.
Oh, well, it's been lovely chatting to you.
Thank you so much for your time.
And take care.
Thank you, and you.
Cheers.
Cheers, Louise.
Well, what about that, Tommy? Could you just stop writing?
Yeah.
I don't know.
But yeah, definitely.
Easily, actually, John. I've been doing that for years. Yeah. I know, I do. I feel the compulsion a bit to write now, but I do thoroughly understand why Louise has reached the point she's reached. I think especially when you've done it professionally.
Yeah, I think you see it in various different levels of people's, whether they're at the start of careers or end of careers or whatever in between. Certainly, like, you know, when people on Twitter kind of will speak their mind or use it as a bit of a sounding board.
Yeah.
It's very easy, isn't it, for that balloon to get deflated.
I think so, yeah.
And just kind of think, sorry, what's the point? And I think we saw the same kind of thing when a lot of the chat about AI was knocking around last month, of just people kind of going, just that deflatedness of like, what's the point? Yeah. Because it does take a lot of time, doesn't it? It takes sweat, blood and tears and all that business. Yeah, so it's not a nothing, is it?
Yeah.
And if you think about it, if you transpose it into anything else, you wouldn't spend ages doing your garden and then horses come and trample over it and you just go, I'll just crack on.
I think books, they're a real heart and soul thing as well, aren't they, a lot of the time? You know, you do pour so much into them. I don't know how I feel now. I feel like maybe slightly deflated, but also happy for Louise as well.
Yeah, there was positivity coming out of it, wasn't there?
Yeah, she's a very positive person.
There's no point doing it regardless, is there, if you're not into it and you're not there anymore.
No.
And just like she says, letting it come round and write for herself, kind of a bit of a rebirth somewhere along the line, maybe.
No, it's brave. Good honour.
And on the back of that, continuing our absolute commitment to only doing fortnightly podcasts, yet again, there's a sneaky little extra episode, isn't there, creeping in?
But we've gone and accidentally made another bonus episode.
Because it's very relevant to what we've just talked to Louise about, because we also spoke to Joanna, who is Louise's agent, or was.
Yeah, Louise's first agent.
First agent, yeah.
Yeah, so it's a sort of a follow-up to this episode, in fact.
A little two-parter, isn't it, really? So we couldn't, it needs to be next to it. That'll be a little extra next week.
Yeah, that's a Failing Writers podcast first as well, because it's obviously a very different point of view as an insider of the traditional publishing industry. So, yeah, it's good. And she's going to give us a few top querying pointers as well. So, yeah, don't miss it.
Absolutely.
It's a good one.
So we put out a bit of a shout out for more people to send in their works in progresses on Twitter, didn't we, John?
We did, yeah, and we had a flurry come in, didn't we?
Yeah, I was thinking we were just getting towards the bottom of the pile, and that'd be nice. We've done that, don't have to read all this stuff anymore. And then John thought, I know what we'll do. Let's get more people to send stuff in.
I'm really enjoying reading them. I want some more. Keep them coming. If you've got a work in progress and you would like us to have a little look at it, and maybe talk about it on the podcast. Well, not maybe. We will talk about it on the podcast. Then, send it to failingwriterspodcast@gmail.com and we'll have a little look. Yeah. First three chapters, something like that.
Yeah.
And a little bit of a précis.
Yeah.
That would be lovely.
A synopsis and a prologue, or do you mean whatever the starting point is, or if you've not yet finished it, or there's, yeah. I don't know, send us a bit of your work in.
You never know, it might help. Have we actually got a name for this now, Tom?
No. No, we absolutely haven't.
Whip up a storm. Whip cream.
Whip cream rises to the top.
Mr. Whippy. Mr. Whippy's big dollop.
All right. So what we got? What have we got for this week?
We have got, well, this one's a little bit different. We got sent a story by Donald Fogarty.
Oh, hold on a minute. Right, because we sent send us the start of like your novels or whatever.
That's right.
And he's tricked us into reading like an entire short story.
Yeah, sneaky.
Yeah, a little bit.
How did he describe it on Twitter?
A self-contained hybrid script / short story.
Ah, yes.
Which, yeah.
Yes.
Did pique our interest slightly, has to be said.
Yeah, it did. I mean, normally we would just, this would go straight in the bin because it doesn't actually follow the rules of whip it out or whatever we're calling it. But we thought this sounded very interesting. What did you think, Tom? Should we have a little listen first to a little bit, a little extract?
Yeah, go on then.
Okay,
yeah.
Let's do that.
Yeah.
Tomorrow, James and the Blue Cat by Donald Fogarty. Ideas are like buses. No, I'll stop you there. I know what you're doing. You're trying to predict the next line, aren't you? Well, it's not that. Two most certainly do not come along at once. Anyway, if you'll promise not to interrupt, I'll carry on. Now, where was I? Ideas are like buses. Some are single story, short, stubby little affairs. Others are more substantial, weighty concerns, like double deckers. And very occasionally, if you wait long enough, a bendy one will come along. A real convoluted concertina of a tale that can twist as well as it can turn. Much like what I'm going to tell you now, I suppose. Hi, it's Jeremy. Oh, that's me on the phone, by the way. Yeah, that's right. In this story, I'm both the protagonist and the narrator. And as you folks who like to predict these things will know, whenever the narrator is also the protagonist, it's usually a bumpy ride. Okay, bye. I'll try not to interrupt again. Agent D in brackets.
Jeremy, why do I know that name?
What? Oh yeah, I should have said, the D in brackets there is short for distort. It helps the Foley editor. He's the sound effects guy. It helps him know that he's supposed to make the actors sound like they're on the phone. Anyway, back to the action. Jeremy, why do you know that name? Because I'm one of your clients? You represent me?
Yes, of course, Jeremy. You're one of my,
One of your screenwriting clients.
Yes, that's it. Now, what can I do for you?
And then I sketched it out for her. Best premise ever. Me at the absolute top of my game. 3 weeks solid from the kernel of an idea to the final draft. And then she said something I'd never heard before. Agent D.
Sounds intriguing. Bit like that what if Harry Potter never existed thing that did the rounds last year. Send it over.
Now, confirmation bias is a funny thing. We see what we want to see. Or in this case, hear what we want to hear. See, I only heard, sounds intriguing, and send it over. The middle bit, yeah, that bit, the bit about my idea being a bit similar to something else, didn't register at all. Oh, sorry, you're being very good, aren't you? I forgot. I told you to stop predicting, didn't I? Right, I'll whiz you through the premise so you're up to speed. Actually, scratch that. Seeing as you're interested in ideas, I'll tell you where it came from first. So, picture the scene. Internal day. Piano bar / upmarket diner. Staff beginning to set up for the evening service. Of course, I don't work there myself. Well, not in any official capacity. And certainly not in any way that HMRC might need to know about. I sort of fell into it, really. The perfect little side hustle helps with the cash flow between writing jobs. Look, there I am now, just coming into shot. That's me at the piano, back to the camera, engrossed in hunting chords.
Now your grip's too strong.
Hang on. C.
Now your grip's too strong.
Yes. C.
Now your grip's too strong.
G.
Can't get started with an F.
Yes, that's the one. And then F. Then I hit upon the lyrics that started it all, and so I began to belt them out on the top of the chords I just found.
Now your grip's too strong, Can't catch love with a net or a gun. Gotta keep faith that your path will change. Gotta keep faith that your luck will change tomorrow.
Now, Annabelle must have arrived for work at that point. She sidles up, sits down next to me on the wide piano stool, kisses my cheek.
Oh, that sounds so nice. Defo, play it to me when you finish writing it, yeah?
Finish writing it? Yeah, I wish. No, it's not mine. It's a James cover. I'm trying to do it for tonight.
What? James, your beautiful blunt.
Oh, just James. They're a band.
They?
Yes, they. There were seven of them. At this point, Annabelle's staring back at me with a face like a meme on Twitter that says, nope. So I name their most famous song. She's got to know that, right? Sit down.
I am sitting down.
No, sit down. It was a massive hit in the 90s. You must have heard of that.
Nope.
Getting Away With It? Anthem for the 2008 financial crash?
Uh-uh.
She's shaking her head like an internet meme again. Anyway, I ran through the lot, all the way up to their Brian Eno collaborations. Not a sausage. She really didn't have a clue what I was talking about. It was as if they'd never existed. Bang. And there was my premise. Right there. Are you ready? Right. Picture this. Piano bar lounge lizard wakes up after a heavy night out to find he's the only person alive who remembers James, knows the whole back catalogue off by heart. Came up with it all there and then, I did. Told her straight away what an inspiration she was. Even went so far as to call her my muse. Annabelle loves it. She even starts suggesting plot points. He becomes famous, is tempted by the groupies, yada yada, but ultimately returns to the arms of his true love. Typical beginner's story arc. So I say, no, my non-screenwriting princess. A more interesting angle would be if, as good as he is, and as good as the songs are, because of who he is, an unknown lounge lizard with zero connections, he goes absolutely nowhere. Like it? Anyway, fast forward to 3 weeks later. I'm just stepping out of the shower and I hear my phone ring. It's my agent. Now, I'd only emailed the script across that morning, so I'm thinking, oops, schoolboy error, must have forgotten to attach it before hitting send. But no, I'm not a schoolboy. It turns out, I'm the consummate professional. Watch.
Oh, Jeremy, this is great. Film/music is so hot as a genre right now. I'm looking at Mamma Mia, that Freddie Mercury biopic. Oh, and what with the piano connection? La La Land.
Really? Does it come across like that? I was sort of hoping that you'd see it as something a bit less, well, commercial, more arty. You know, like A Star Is Born, or gritty, like that Hacienda docudrama.
Yeah, that could work too. Listen, don't get your hopes up, but I'm getting a good vibe about this one. I'll put some feelers out and get back to you.
She'd get back to me. Now that was an alien concept. No one ever gets back to me. I'm always the one that does the chasing. But true to her word, things moved pretty fast, and over the course of the following few weeks, she did, indeed, get back to me. Several times.
Jeremy, great news. Blue Cat Productions want to option it.
Who?
You know, they did Walking on Sunshine and the Elton John story.
What? Really? I thought I said I didn't want to go too commercial with this one.
Yeah, I tried that, love. The indies won't look at it. Music purchase rights would have been too steep. Blue Cat were the only ones with the pockets and connections to clear the soundtrack.
And I repeat my question, Tom. What did you think?
I liked it. When he first sent it through, I had a really quick peek through on the link.
Mm.
And immediately after reading like two or three paragraphs, I thought, oh yeah, this is going to be fun. Because a good bit of playing with the form, and I was going to say breaking the fourth wall, but it's kind of all just, it's just smashing it down, isn't it, with a hammer and ignoring it was over there in the first place.
It is, yeah. I did a similar thing. I thought, I'll just have a quick look, and then ended up reading it all, which I think is a good sign.
Yeah. And that's all we've got to say about it. No, it's not, is it?
No, it's not.
It just felt like it was. Felt like it was forced.
Yeah, I liked the style of it. Like you say, it was very very sort of chatty.
Brisk.
Affable,
yeah, had a lovely
style.
Yeah, lovely little skip in its step.
A likeable character. It was almost sort of deliberately overly conversational,
yeah,
for comic effect. To the extent that the narrator he's almost kind of struggling to get to the point sometimes. But I thought that worked very well. It gave you a good sense of who he was, a slightly sort of intense, overly chatty writer.
Yeah, I think so. And there was some good pithy humour in there as well, wasn't
there?
None of it was like falling on the floor laughing, but it was that lovely humour that kind of takes you along with it, because you kind of half know the punchline, but you're enjoying, because it's being revealed within a conversation, you're enjoying the revelation of it as well. Yeah. So there's a bit where he's trying to explain the James songs.
Oh, yeah. To the sit down.
Jeremy's explaining to him. But yeah, exactly. Sit down. I am sitting down. No, sit down.
Yeah.
It's that thing where it's obvious, but it's funny because it progresses the story as well. So it's it's that double whammy. So it's quite enjoyable to read.
It is. I think. And involves, as you just said, involves the band James. And being a bit of a James fan myself, it added another little layer of
pleasure. I thought
that
was such a good pick as well, actually. Because this is all pastiche and kind of the idea that it's an idea that's already been had, but better with someone doing it with the Beatles. Mm. And I just thought James was a brilliantly positioned, sized band to use. Do you know what I mean? It was just the right...
I know what you mean.
They were quite big at the time, but they're not really big anymore. But they still exist in the conscious... Do you mean they're still a thing? So it's not like they're nothing, but it's not like they were never the biggest band in the world, but they were really quite big at the time.
That's it. It's like he's got it very slightly wrong, the writer. Do you know what I mean? This, the character.
Yeah.
It's not quite... Like, obviously, Beatles would have been better, but it's still, like, believable. But yeah, I like the story. I thought the story was really interesting. It is obviously a parody of real life events. It's basically what happened to writer Jack Barth when he wrote a screenplay about a musician who wakes up one morning to find that no one's heard of the Beatles, obviously, that went on to become the film Yesterday. But that ended up being credited entirely to Richard Curtis and Danny Boyle, with absolutely no credit to the writer Jack Barth whatsoever. Like the original writer. I think he got paid for it, but he didn't get any, you know, proper recognition for it.
Yeah.
But then did you happen to have a look on Donald Fogerty's website? Because he's written kind of a blog called The Maris Piper Mystery. And then things got even more interesting because he tells a true story about being the victim of... suspected plagiarism.
Oh, yes.
Did you see that?
I did see, yeah.
Because he thinks someone might have taken an idea of his and turned it into a radio play without his permission.
Yeah.
But it's a really fascinating little story. And he ends up going to an event where the writer who's got the credit for it, who he thinks has nicked his story.
And asked him where he came up with the idea.
Yeah, is being interviewed. He's being interviewed live and he's passed the mic. But yeah, it's good. It's a really good little story. We'll put the link in the show notes so you can have a read. But I recommend it. It's good. But yeah, so the whole idea of ripping off other people's ideas is obviously quite a pertinent theme for Donald.
If we'd have been smarter, we would have read this story out and just claimed it as our own in a full circle.
Yeah, like that.
That we should have done that, shouldn't we?
Yeah, we should have done that. But the payoff is good. That's the other thing about the story. The payoff of the story is good. It sort of flips the whole idea on its head. But you'll have to read it. You'll have to go to his website and read it.
Yeah, so if you want to read that, click through on the show notes on the link or type in donaldfogerty.com. That's a shortcut if you want to do it that way. A lot of the kids are doing that these days, just typing in URLs and going straight to the website. And read the rest of it. It's worth a little read.
It is. Very original.
Yeah, it was very enjoyable.
It was. And actually genuinely made me think about plagiarism in the media industry as well. And possibly how rife it is.
Well, that's what I was going to say. It left a little bit of a feeling of being unnerved or think, well, is this just happening everywhere then?
Yeah, yeah.
Kind of just made it feel a bit like, oh.
Everyone's up to it.
And then so a big name writer's just taking what they want. Like some kind of modern day writing Vikings.
Yeah.
Just popping over and raping and pillaging people's screenplays.
Which clearly must happen.
Burning down their villages. Well, that's a jolly note to finish on, isn't it? Something that was basically enjoyable.
What would you do? What would you do, Tommy, if you found out someone had stolen your idea? Would you be...
Well, this has happened to me.
What, has it?
Yeah.
Really?
Quite a while ago when I was working in advertising, I went to the head office of Greggs, which I don't know if you're aware, but it's a popular high street baking chain. They produce sausage rolls.
Oh, yeah,
that and one. Other baked products. So we went to see them about some possible radio advertising sponsorship or something like that. And I said to them, because I always, my marketing head is always going. I'm always thinking. Mm. Do you know what I mean? I'm just always on, always on.
That's true. That is true.
And I said to them, have you ever thought about selling your products in a retail environment? Because obviously you send them to the stores frozen.
Mm.
You literally would just be looking at distribution.
Mm.
So you've got all your manufacturing in place. It would just be a case of finding a partner to probably go exclusive through and sell your sausage rolls in a supermarket.
Mm.
And then not too long after that, you could start buying Greg's sausage rolls in Iceland, I believe. So tell me that's a coincidence, is it?
Wow.
That's a coincidence?
Doesn't sound like it, Tommy. Sounds like that was your idea and they just stole it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And you're owed a lot of money now.
We should have thought of that. Never mind.
Yeah, we need to stop giving our best ideas away, Tom.
Yeah.
I mean, that's practically what we do on this podcast.
It's true, yeah.
All our best ideas, we just give them away for free. Luckily, none of them are any good, so that's fine.
Not really.
All
well,
good. Well, that probably wraps things up, I reckon.
Yeah.
Although it is that bit in the show where we tilt our heads slightly.
What are we doing?
And make our eyes look really big.
Why are you doing that? You're all right.
To anime puppy dogs.
What's wrong?
And then we add some really emotional music.
I'm tearing up here. I don't even know what you're going to say, but I'm tearing up.
If you enjoy the podcast, please subscribe.
Yeah.
We can only do this with your help. So could you go and tell your friends about us?
Yeah, definitely.
And leave a review, please. That would be nice. Do you know what, Tom? This is a genuine question now, which you can either edit out of this or you can leave it.
Because obviously the entirety rest of the podcast is completely scripted. But this is just happening. Yeah.
Yeah. People this is just by anyway. The by.
Yeah. Yeah.
We haven't had a review for ages. Do you find that a little bit weird? Like we used to have a nice steady stream of reviews and then nothing for ages. And I'm thinking there's something wrong with like the reviewing software of the internet or something.
Obviously it must be, yeah. I don't know. Yeah.
It must be. The reviewing capabilities of the web are down at the moment.
I think
that's what it'll be.
Do you not think it's more the point that people just take us for granted now? Like when we were new and fun and everything.
Yeah, maybe.
Like, oh wow, these guys. Oh.
Yeah.
And now they're just like, yeah, whatever.
That's probably it.
Oh, there's another brilliant episode. Whatever.
We're just background waffle now, aren't we?
Yeah, exactly.
People are, they're going about their business, they're cooking, they're half listening. And they probably turned us off by now. They're not even listening now, are they?
Yeah, that's remember fair, we need to open the show with desperate pleas. But if you are a new listener and you feel like you've discovered something and you want to share that with the world, then please, please do. Or maybe we should just set people a challenge. And if you want to video yourself doing it and put it on our Twitter of telling random people about the Failing Writers podcast. So like if
just
you're
going, approaching people in the street.
Yep, you're at a bus stop. Just film yourself telling someone, or maybe you're ordering a coffee, or maybe a Greg's sausage roll.
Ideally, first of all, just put your headphones on and then laugh hysterically so that everyone looks at you.
Yeah.
And then turn to them and go, it's this podcast, The Failing Writers.
Bloody good. I mean, they haven't got any recent reviews, but check out their reviews online.
Old reviews.
Check out their 18-month-old reviews. They're probably still relevant.
Listen to us obsessing over our reviews. Let's move on. In fact,
we know the hunger's out there, though, John. We know the hunger's out there just from the way people have been demanding T-shirts.
Good point, Tom.
So,
good point.
That's going to be our next thing, isn't it? To do some merch, to get some fun time merch out there.
Yeah. We're going to work on that. We are going to work on that. Definitely.
Yeah.
Right. Let's leave these nice people alone so they can go and do some writing.
Sorry for bothering you.
Thanks for listening, everybody. Lovely hanging out with you yet again.
Yeah.
Don't let the bastards grind you.
Absolutely. Keep writing. Keep writing.
Hello?
Hello?
Where's everybody gone?